The House Workforce Development Finance Committee will come to order. Lee Baker, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I'll make a motion, we approve the minutes.
All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carries. All right, first on the agenda this morning is House File 20, Representative Beeman's bill. I will move that House File 20 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. See that there is an author's amendment, the chair moves that the A3 author amendment. Representative Beeman, can you briefly describe the amendment and we will take a vote on the adoption of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's nice to be back in workforce. My author's amendment puts the bill in the shape that I wanted and includes some compliance language that we've been working on with DEED and the appropriations for the reimbursement accounts.
Okay. Questions? All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The author's amendment is prevails. I believe you have some testifiers this morning. The first person is Commissioner Steve Grove. Commissioner, please. Okay. Then next is Commissioner is not here yet, so we'll move to Julia Wolf.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beeman.
Can I present my bill before we have our testifiers?
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am also excited for our testifiers. We have a full room of folks who are impacted by this, so I promise I will not keep you from them. But I am really grateful to be here in Workforce to present House File 20, which is a legislation that will end the exclusion of hourly school workers from our unemployment insurance program. For folks who are on Workforce in the last couple of years, you've heard this bill a couple of times. We actually passed it off the House floor last year, and it went into conference. I think that this is the year that we have to get this done. This important policy ensures that tens of thousands of our bus drivers, paraprofessionals, educational assistants, custodial staff, food service, and other hourly workers in our schools, our colleges, and our universities have the same access to unemployment insurance that other Minnesota workers have when they become unemployed. This bill is simple. It adds a provision to current law that hourly workers in our schools and campuses can use the wage credits that they earned to collect unemployment insurance if they're otherwise eligible for unemployment benefits. In other words, it removes the blanket exclusion in current law that prevents hourly school workers from being able to access unemployment benefits between the academic terms. It also sets up a reimbursement account to support our school districts, the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, and tribal colleges by reimbursing the cost of this policy change. We know that these Minnesotans are doing amazing work in our schools and on our campuses. They're the hardworking and often lowest paid workers, and they feed, drive, care for, and clean up after our students. These workers have deserved this fairness that this bill would provide, but the disruption and the hardship of the last few years have only increased the need for this change. I want to highlight a few reasons why this policy is so important to both our schools, our campuses, and also our workforce. First, this is a critical safety net for Minnesotans working paycheck to paycheck to care for our students. Most Minnesotans need to work year-round, and these workers are no exception. And they're already underpaid. Many of them are making at or under $15 an hour, some without access to health insurance and other kinds of insurance. They're paid and living paycheck to paycheck, and they're working to support their families. Providing this economic safety net, if they're out of work through no fault of their own, is exactly what unemployment insurance is meant to do. It's the safety net that most Minnesotans rely on and have access to protect their economic security if they need it. This policy will provide stability for our students, our classrooms, and on our campuses by providing that economic security for our workforce. We have a workforce staffing crisis in our schools and on our campuses. I hear about it in my district all the time. Bus drivers, paras. I'm hearing about it from college students who don't have food service workers. I'm sure that you are hearing about it too. And I know that that particular issue is of importance to this committee. A shortage of school bus drivers means parents left to figure out how to get their kids to school. It means kids in classrooms left with insufficient support of ESPs and paras. It means campuses without staff to provide transportation, food service, and custodial services that our students rely on. It's stressful for our students, our teachers, our school districts, and our campuses, and obviously for the workers and their families themselves. Our current law makes it harder to recruit and retain these workers that schools rely on. These are positions with high turnover and often low pay, and there's often no guarantee of work for 3 or 4 months out of the year. Excluding these workers from unemployment insurance makes it harder to retain them, as workers oftentimes decide to move on to other jobs when they're essentially laid off at the end of a school year without the certainty of a paycheck to make them to the next fall. The exclusion in law means that schools lose valuable staff and our students lose important relationships with caring adults. This provides that stability in our workforce. It provides the opportunity to keep and retain these workers. Last, this is just the fair thing to do. These workers are playing these essential roles, and they are often women, folks of color, and they get a lot of lip service from us all and the public about how important they are to running our schools. But we need to do more than just lip service. We need to ensure that they have the economic security to continue to do the work that they love with our kids. The status quo is not working for Minnesota workers. Current law treats workers doing the same job differently based on who their employer is. It creates a situation where two food service workers who are doing the exact same work are treated differently. If you're employed by a private subcontractor, you're eligible for unemployment benefits in Minnesota under Minnesota law, while the person who is employed by the school district is not. The current law also treats workers who have seasonal unemployment differently. Landscaping, resort employees, construction, those workers are all eligible for unemployment to use their wage credits when they're laid off during those downtimes. They're eligible for unemployment, while school workers are not. That's just not fair, and this bill will end that fundamental fairness. So I just ask you, as you hear the testimony today, think about these Minnesotans who are driving bus, who are preparing lunches and food, who are assisting our kids, our students, our college students in the classroom, and ask why they don't deserve the same economic security as other Minnesota workers have had. It's time to end this 80-year exclusion of these workers, and I look forward to the conversation, and I look forward to hearing the testimony from these Minnesotans who do so much in our schools and campuses. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will now turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. So, Mr. Grove, are you on? If you're on, please unmute yourself and proceed.
Chair Zhang, members of the committee, Steve Grove, Commissioner of D, can you hear me okay? Coming in remotely? Okay, I'm seeing nods. Thanks for giving me a moment to testify on behalf of this package, one that the governor supports. He feels very strongly, as do I, that this is a concern for our K-12 schools, a concern for our workforce, and these workers are currently not eligible for these benefits and need to be. And we think this is a matter of basic fairness in our system and one in which this body should move quickly to fix. I say this just from a personal note, coming from a family of seasonal workers myself. My father, growing up, had a small landscaping company, and of course in the winter hard to plant many trees in Minnesota, so he had a seasonal dynamic for his workforce, and his workers were able to take unemployment insurance in the winter and then come back in the spring. Meanwhile, my mom worked as a paraprofessional in public schools, and every summer when she left her job for the summer was not afforded that same opportunity. And the fairness of that, I think, clearly needs to be rectified. We have a strong unemployment insurance system in our state, one that works really well, one that has a history of doing right by Minnesota workers. And so I want to thank the author, Representative Greenman, for her hard work on this bill, as well as all the advocates here. The governor stands very much in favor of expanding this benefit to K-12 workers eligible to collect these benefits between terms. And I have in the room today with you all my colleague, Deputy Commissioner Evan Rowe from the department, who can answer any questions later as they may come up as we walk through these testifiers. But here today to start things off with just a note of support from the governor, lieutenant governor, and myself here at Deed. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next is Julia Wolf, who is also on Zoom. Please unmute yourself and proceed.
Hello. I'm going to share my screen real quick because I have a PowerPoint presentation to share with you all. 1 second. All right. Everyone should be able to see that now. Hello, my name is Julia Wolf. Thank you so much to the committee for having me here today. My co-author on this report, Dave Camper, who is a Minnesotan, was unfortunately unable to join today, but wanted me to pass along his regards. He had really hoped to have the honor of speaking before the committee and Representative Hemmingsen Yeager in particular. He's told me how much of a pleasure it's been to see her working for the people of her district and for Minnesota. So thank you all for having me here today. And I'm here to present some research that Dave and I did on the impact of this bill. So I'm here to provide some data on school support staff in general, who they are, and then also estimate the effect that this bill would have in Minnesota based on the impact of a similar policy that was implemented in Illinois in 2020. In our report, we found that extending UI eligibility to school workers over the summer would provide targeted relief and ongoing support to workers who need it without imposing an undue economic burden on school districts. The impact estimates are from this 2021 report that I co-authored during my time at the Economic Policy Institute. You can find a link to the full report on this slide, which I believe you all have copies of, if you want to dive more into the detail on the methodology, although I'm happy to answer questions here too. And I should also mention that I'm not currently working at EPI, so I'm not actually speaking as a representative of the organization today, but still happy to speak as an expert who was one of the authors on this report. So to begin, here's a chart that displays the makeup of school support staff by gender and by race and ethnicity. This is national level data to ensure that we have adequate sample size, just an FYI. And the top section of this chart shows that nearly 3/4 of this workforce is women compared to a much more even split in the overall workforce. And then the bottom chart shows that Black and Hispanic workers are also disproportionately likely to be employed in this sector. So in short, people who are in groups that have been historically excluded from economic opportunities, who face discrimination in the labor market, and who are subject to wage gaps are disproportionately represented in this workforce. And now this chart gives another sense of kind of the particular economic need of this group of workers. This chart compares median weekly wages for support staff occupations. We have 4 occupations listed below. And then that top bar is comparing it to the overall workforce. So the lower wages that you see here for education support staff reflect their lower hourly pay, as well as the fact that they might be working fewer hours on a weekly basis. What isn't reflected in this chart is the fact that some of these workers are not employed by schools year round. And so that would, you know, make this an even more economically stressful situation for them to be underpaid, as we see here in this chart. Oh, and I should note, this data is from a report my colleagues did linking pay in K-12 schools to the staffing shortages, which I think everyone would find relevant if you want to check that report out as well. Now, moving on to the Minnesota-specific estimates. So in order to estimate the effects of this bill, we needed to first estimate recipiency, meaning how many people would actually end up receiving the benefit. In Minnesota, the overall pre-pandemic recipiency rate was around 40% for the whole workforce, but that doesn't necessarily reflect this particular workforce, since that could differ for support staff because some may continue to work over the summer, or they might have additional employment over the summer outside of the school district. So that's why having this comparison from Illinois was really valuable data that we were able to leverage to get a better sense of what the actual uptake would be in Minnesota. So we were able to use that recipiency rate along with the UI compensation rate and some wage data to estimate the overall benefit to workers as well as the cost to school district. One FYI, you'll notice me jumping a little bit when I talk about the costs and benefits between talking about weeks and talking about people. That's one of the tricky things about quantifying this is we often talk about weeks of unemployment benefits, and that's how a lot of the data is. But sometimes I switch to talking about people just to give a better, more tangible sense of the impact of this. All right, so in Illinois, they enacted summer UI for support staff in 2020. Specifically, it was for non-instructional staff, which is just to note like the specific designation they used, but by and large, it's the same group of staff that would be affected in Minnesota. And so we focused, again, our analysis on K-12 in particular here. So after adjusting for the 2020 pandemic job losses, we were able to use administrative data that Illinois' Department of Ed put out to find that the number of weeks of UI claimed was equivalent to approximately 11% of their support staff workforce claiming UI benefits for the full summer. That's the equivalent amount of weeks. So if that pattern followed in Minnesota, which we have no reason to think the recipient rate in Minnesota would be different from Illinois, we estimate that over 75,000 weeks about of UI would be claimed in Minnesota, which is the equivalent of 6,800 employees claiming UI for the full summer. And then we take that, the average weekly pay, divide that by half because 50% is the UI compensation rate. And so if someone were to claim that at the average wage rate for 11 weeks of benefits over the summer, that would be about $4,000. And so that's the benefit to workers that I want to lift up. That would make a real meaningful difference for the support staff that keeps schools running during the school year and that are already facing low wages in their jobs. So this would make a real significant difference for people. And now I'll switch to talking about the net cost. So to get an estimate of this, we simply take that weekly wage times the benefit rate of 50% and the total number of weeks claimed that we estimate will be claimed across the state. This amounts to about 1.1% of school districts' total reserves. And so we really feel pretty strongly that the individual benefit is real, as I mentioned on the last slide. And then as we show on this slide, the cost to school districts is manageable, given that it's only 1.1% of school districts' total reserves. So please feel free to reach out if you have any clarifying questions. I'm sure my co-author Dave would also be happy to help. And thank you again so much for having me here to present this data today.
Thank you. Next testifier is Scott McMahon. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Banks.
Just a quick question. I know that we didn't have a presentation in our packets with this, and there's a lot of facts there. That is being sent out to us?
The presentation was sent late this morning. So staff did not get a chance to print it, but we'll make sure to email it to you. It's already just been sent off.
Thank you so much. I want to take that out. There's a lot of information there and important information. Thank you.
We'll make sure you get it. Oh, Representative Becker-Fent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let the other committee members know maybe it will help with your focus, but I did bring some coffee to share.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I might need some too. Thank you, Representative Becker-Fent. Mr. McMahon, identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Scott McMahon with Flaherty & Hood, here today on behalf of our client, the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. The Operators Association represents the private contractors who contract other school districts to transport our kids to and from school every day for activities and so on and so forth. We represent about 60% of the bus routes on a daily basis in the state. And to give you a sense on that, there are about 12,000 yellow buses in the state of Minnesota. So about 60% of those are our bus drivers. And that doesn't take into account type 3 drivers, which would be drivers driving cars and vans, transporting students that way. So we are a significant portion of the school transportation infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. To give you another sense as to who our members are, the vast majority of our members are small family businesses. They are community members. They're serving all districts across the state, Minneapolis, St. Paul, the suburbs, greater Minnesota. I just spoke with one of our operators over the weekend to give you an example of, as to how they operate. In the past 5 years, they have increased the hourly rate for their drivers by 50%. In those 5 years, their income has not changed. This year, they are going back to their school district to ask for a 10% increase in their contract, and that's to cover three expenses. Driver costs, the cost for new school buses, which have increased 20 to 30% in the past 2 years, and the added fuel cost. There is no additional revenue that they are intending to ask from their school district to compensate them. So that'll be 6 or 7 years that they have gone without increasing their pay over that time. This bill, as it stands right now, has some concerns for us. And to use the usual legislative term, we're not quite at peace in the valley, but I think we can get there with some modifications to the bill. We've been working over the past 4 weeks with the school administration folks, with the unions, to try and figure out how we can get there. The issues that we have with the bill right now begin with the funding on it. Right now, there isn't a direct appropriation included in the bill. I know there's a call-out spot for it, but we just want to be on record saying that for this to go forward, we need it to be fully funded. The districts need the revenue in order to pay the increased unemployment costs. When the governor released his budget, they had projected costs in the out years in the neighborhood of $340 million for the next biennium. We don't think that those numbers are too off from what we, on the back of the envelope, are trying to calculate within our industry. We've done some simulations within our operators, and we're seeing annual costs in the range of $50,000 to $200,000 per contract. And so if you extrapolate that across all the various contracts and operators and different employees, that $340 million is probably in the right ballpark. The second issue we have is right now in the bill, there's a reimbursement account established, NDE, that would be funded with funds to pay for these expenses. And those funds would be available for school districts, but they'd only be available to pay the increased cost for those school district employees. So what that means is for us, as our costs increase $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 per year, and we go back to the school district, the only revenue source that they have to pay those increased costs are the general fund. So every superintendent is going to be sitting there thinking, do I increase my transportation contract, or do I put new textbooks in our classrooms? If our contractors were able to have their increased costs funded out of the same revenue bucket that the districts have for paying their increased unemployment costs, then we can move towards peace in the valley on this issue. And to give you an example as to how this can play out, right now, districts can choose to provide their own transportation services or they can contract. Currently, districts have access to the same bucket of money for each of those two decisions, so we're comparing apples to apples. If this goes through as it is right now, all of a sudden we start comparing apples and rutabagas. So to put an illustration behind this, and these are not accurate numbers, I say this only to illustrate the point. If a district is putting out to bid a transportation contract, and one of my members come forward and says, I can do this for $900,000, and the district says, we can do this for $1 million, so the $900,000 is better, but there's $200,000 in unemployment costs embedded in that contract, all of a sudden, the general fund impact for the school district to run it is $800,000. The general fund impact for the contractor to do it is $900,000. Even though our contract is less expensive, the fiscal impact for the general fund for the schools slants towards the districts doing it. And so if we can put everybody having access to the same funding mechanism to do this, it allows the districts to operate in an apples-to-apples situation and make things work from that standpoint. The last point that I have today is under state statute, school districts and operators are able to enter into contracts of up to 10 years. So we have had contractors and districts enter 8, 9, 10-year contracts this year. This proposal would go into place starting this year. It would take about a 3-year rollout before the full fiscal impact is kind of in place for districts. This is a significant impact that isn't accounted for in those contracts. Obviously, we have situations where we can go back to the district and say, can we open the contract and build in these costs? But it's up to the district to kind of say, we're going to do this, we're not going to do this. As this bill goes forward, we'd like to figure out language that would allow the state to basically say, districts, stop for a second. If these costs impact you, then you need to bring you need to amend your contract so that these new fiscal realities are in place. Because if we have operators who can't bring these costs into their contracts for 6, 7, 8, 9 years, those contractors will leave industry. There's no question of that whatsoever. So we're working with the school administration folks. We're working with the unions on these issues. We think we can get peace in the valley. It's not there right now, but we're on a path to do that. If we can just find a time between now and this bill being processed along the way to find a time for us to work on the right language, I think we can get there. So happy to answer any questions the members may have.
Thank you, Mr. McMahon. Next is Denise Dietrich, and after that is Laura Comforter. If you can be up and ready to testify, we have several testifiers this morning. Ms. Dietrich, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We appreciate the opportunity to address the committee with some concerns on House File 20. We have had several meetings with Representative Greenman, and we will continue to work with her in regarding the impact that this bill will have on school districts. So I think we can all agree that House File 20 would increase the likelihood that school district employees would be eligible to receive unemployment benefits during the summer months. That I should have said more in school district employees would be eligible to receive unemployment benefits during the summer months, assuming that they meet all the eligibility requirements. This likelihood presents three areas of concern for school districts, and they are, first of all, the ability to hire high-quality staff for our summer programming. Second, the long-term unemployment costs to the schools and the property taxpayers, and the logistics once implemented. So our schools provide essential summer programming, which has positive effects on student achievement, and there is research that demonstrates that. As you can imagine, it is important that summer programming be taught and supported by qualified personnel in a safe setting to realize the maximum benefits to student outcomes and achievement. Currently, districts report difficulty in filling summer learning programs, which includes paraprofessionals, transportation personnel, and sometimes food service employees. If districts are unable to hire sufficient summer school employees, these valuable education programs in the summer cannot be offered, and in the long run, this hurts our students. We hope that this bill doesn't inadvertently provide employees an incentive to not fulfill the essential summer programs that we have open and already struggle to fill. The second concern is cost to the property taxpayer and to the school. House File 2 creates a K-12 school reimbursement account with a one-time capped transfer from the general fund. Once this funding is depleted, school districts would use the unemployment levy to cover these costs, and this would be a property tax increase into the future. In the long run, property tax increases may hinder the local district's efforts in passing much-needed operating referendums. So last thought on the cost is we would respectfully request that this program, if passed, be fully funded and would be funded into the future. We still do have many questions as far as the logistics of the program go, and so we are continuing to meet with Representative Greenman to address these and to DEED to get a better understanding of how the current unemployment law in the new program applies to school district non-licensed employees. For example, what does suitable employment mean in a school district setting? What happens if an hourly school employee is offered a summer position that is not in line with their current position regarding work, wages, and hours, since many of our summer programs are 3 to 4 days a week and often half-day programs? So I would close with this thought. We share your goal to supplement or increase low-wage employees in our school districts, and we want to work together to find a solution, one that is fully funded and does not hinder our efforts to provide summer school programming for our school districts. We look forward to future discussions and working with Representative Greenman in the future on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Next is Laura Carpenter, followed by Kat Briggs. Please be up and ready to testify.
Mr. Chair.
Carpenter, please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair.
And proceed. Representative Frazier.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Are we holding questions until the end?
We'll do after. I want to give time to our testifiers to speak.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning. Hi, my name is Laura Carpenter. I work with SEIU now, but before this, I was a food service worker in Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm also the parent of two elementary age children. As a former educator and a parent, I have seen how hourly school employees struggle to care for their own families with low pay and without the safety net of access to unemployment insurance in the summer months. I have also seen all the love for their students the hourly school staff bring to their jobs. In the district where I worked and where my children attend, we continue to lose beloved staff each year to more stable employment. Relationships are the foundation of our school communities, and our students deserve and need stability. My son relies on the support of paraprofessionals every day in order to access his education. These supportive relationships take a lot of time to build, and they require a lot of trust to be successful. Every year, my child has had to get to know new paras that then inevitably leave for a more stable job at the end of the year. This instability has been hard on my son. Chronic understaffing has become a huge problem for families in our schools. I don't know a parent who hasn't had trouble with late or canceled buses. In the past couple of years, I have on several occasions gotten a text from the school that there is no driver for the afternoon bus home and families must come get their students at school. I've then gone to pick up my kids and the neighbor's kids because I'm the one with the car. And our school has often had open para positions, leaving less staff responsible for the same amount of support needs, leading to students not actually having their needs met. Last fall, my son's special education teacher went on paternity leave for 3 weeks. The school was already short-staffed and missing 2 out of 4 paras for his program. Then the substitute teacher quit at the end of the second week, citing difficulties keeping up with everyone's needs with only half of the support staff in place. And the school then did not have an alternative substitute available and called each family to tell us that we would not have a sub the next week, explained that it would mean not being able to follow everyone's IEP or their schedule, and offered for us to have our students stay home for 1 week with excused absences. My son and his peers literally did not have access to their education at all for an entire week last fall because of short staffing. I am not surprised that our district is having trouble finding people to step into these open positions as long as they are low-wage jobs without any safety net throughout the summer months of via UI. We will continue to see understaffing, which has a negative impact on our students, especially students with disabilities. Expanding access to unemployment insurance to hourly school workers means more stability for the dedicated staff who care for our children and youth, more caring people who are able to make careers out of schoolwork, and more stability and support for our students. Thank you.
Thank you. Kat Briggs, followed by Teresa Benger. Kat Briggs, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kat Briggs, and I am a school bus driver for Independent School District 196. When I left corporate America, I wanted to give back to my community. Growing up, I had the same bus driver from elementary school through my senior year in high school. Peggy, bus 39, knew my name, where I lived, and what my schedule was. She took me to and from school each day, as well as driving me to various athletic events and field trips. She was a great school bus driver, and I hope I make the same impact on my students that she made on me. When I started my bus driving career, I was naive. I thought I was able to get unemployment, just like my sons who work construction. I was so struck by the fact that there was a state statute that prevented hourly school employees from collecting unemployment benefits due to, quote, reasonable assurance of employment in the fall. Other seasonal employees have reasonable assurance of work, but still get access to the safety net program. My boys may not have known exactly what job they were going to report to in the spring, but they knew there would always be concrete to pour. My husband is a farmer. My first year driving coincided with a bad weather year for farming. Had it not been for a federal program, we would have lost our home the first year I drove for ISD 196. Had it not been for an incentive bonus and back pay from contract negotiations, I would not have made it through my cancer diagnosis this past summer. School workers shouldn't be asked to go from financial crisis to financial crisis. We deserve the same benefit everyone else gets. The first summer of COVID, I did get unemployment compensation. Because of the pandemic and the school shutdown, my unemployment claim was approved. We still had to be careful with our money, but we didn't have to scrimp and save the way we had to do every other year. I could drive to my son's place in Kenyon to help with my new grandbaby and not have to worry about affording gas. It was a small amount of money, but it made a huge difference. I worry for our new employees. No one tells them they can't get unemployment. I worry for myself and my coworkers as inflation has eaten into my wallet, making my summer months scary again. Summer work is available at approximately 16 hours per week for 3 to 6 weeks at most. I fear that as we hire drivers and they learn that there is not enough work during the summer months and they cannot collect unemployment benefits, they will quit and take their commercial driver's licenses down the street. It's critical that we have the best people to drive our kids. And when they're on my bus, they're my kids. We are understaffed and constantly trying to recruit new drivers and chaperones. All school districts are in a recruiting and retention crisis in each and every department. Children need consistency in their lives these days as the world has become inconsistent for them. What better way to show consistency than to have the same bus drivers, chaperones, food service, and other staff year to year? Give us the opportunity to receive unemployment compensation. It is not a handout. It is not forever. It is not at the expense of education budgets. It is something that equalizes hourly school employees with the rest of the hourly employees in this state. You, as legislators, have the ability to make unemployment benefits a reality for hourly school employees like myself and my coworkers. It is time to make this a permanent reality for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Briggs. Next is Teresa. Please unmute yourself, followed by Aaron McKinney. These people are to testify.
My name is Teresa Greniger. I'm a special ed paraprofessional at King Elementary in Deer River. I've been in the educational field for about 15 years, 9 years here. My annual income is $21,829, $1,200 below the federal poverty line for my family of three. Because I'm ineligible for unemployment, my wages are prorated into 12 months and I'm forced to live and raise my children before the federal poverty guideline. Each summer I look for work, but I'm always called back to King because I feel passionate about the future of the children I work with. We build bonds and invest part of ourselves to make these children successful, not only with their education, but with their school, social and emotional development. I make a difference in these children's lives every day, but it's at the expense of my family and my health. When I started working at King, prorating my pay allowed me to spread my checks throughout the summer and avoid the cost of four kids in daycare. Even with this job and county assistance, being a single mom, we just scrape by. I live in a rented house with poor insulation. My electricity bill in the winter is more than I make in 2 weeks. We have dual fuel, but I can't afford propane. I use space heaters on my main level when the heat portion of my electricity gets shut off. I don't make enough to qualify for a house loan, and I can't afford over $1,000 a month rent. This is my only option. I was hospitalized this summer for 4 days due to a tooth infection that wouldn't go away with antibiotics. I now have a temporary crown that's infected and loose, and I'm trying to save up the $3,000 to have it fixed. As many of you know, we worked at on the front lines of the pandemic, putting our families at risk, but we weren't paid like it. People on unemployment made more in a week than I did in 2 weeks. As a school worker, when I'm told we're not eligible for unemployment insurance, what I hear is that we aren't valued. What I hear is that our contribution to our students and their future goes unseen. If we were able to receive it, we could get our full pay and be closer to rising above the poverty level. We wouldn't have to work 2 jobs or more and come into school exhausted, and we'd be able to give more to our students. Minnesota schools couldn't run without us. We're finally hiring a few new paras, but without your action now, we may lose more experienced staff over the summer. I know our school can't afford that. Please, we need your help now. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Next, Aaron McKinney, please unmute yourself and proceed, followed by Bill Schwant.
Good morning. My name is Aaron McKinney, and I'm a paraprofessional in Deer River School District number 317. I am here without much hope. We as a support staff feel forgotten by our state. However, I will try to put my voice out there in the hopes that it may reach your ears and your hearts. I have been in the industry for several years now. I felt burned out by the education system after 4 years and took a 2-year break to work other careers. But I missed education, and when given the chance to come back to working with students, I jumped on it. Going back into that career required me to look at why I felt so passionate about rejoining it, despite knowing that it wouldn't pay more. If you ask any teacher in any district, they would say that the value of a paraprofessional is immeasurable. We work with students on the front line every day to provide a safe, loving place to get the best education we can provide. No matter what department, EBD, DCD, SLD, food service, bus drivers, you pour yourself into these kids. We may have less meetings and paperwork, but we put a lot of the same work in as teachers. Most paraprofessionals are also in charge of recess and other student interactions that require them to develop a good relationship with most of the students in the building and not just the ones they service. We work hard to provide more than just learning. We all spend money out of our own pockets for student enrichment, not just teachers, and with no budget provided. I personally spend between $300 and $500 of my own money each year on supplies and student enrichment purposes. I'm working for the same pay as many high school students starting out in fast food. I'm one of many, many paraprofessionals working another and sometimes multiple jobs to make up for the low wages and lack of unemployment insurance. Most of us are also not kids starting out alone. Most of us have families that we are supporting, some of us on our own. We sacrifice money to work in an industry where we know we make a difference in the world. To know that I could shift industries and work in elder care for almost twice the money is not lost on me. I could look for another job, one that I am certainly skilled enough for and that would provide me more financial stability and incentive. That is an option for anyone in any industry, it's true. The whole idea of if you don't like it, go back to school or change jobs is an option for people. But that would mean that I wasn't taking into consideration the things beyond pay that I get out of working in education. It would mean that I wasn't equating my financial value to my skill properly. I help these kids grow and learn. I've watched that evolve into older kids with pride and goals. I've worked with kids who distrust all adults, fostering warmth and trust. I've taken time to volunteer, donate, and a million other things to enrich the lives of all the students in my building. What are those people worth to you? What are the children of the future worth to you? If pay and unemployment insurance isn't dealt with, what level of staff will be left to educate and grow the next generation? Or the one after that? It's time to take education seriously on a financial level and realize why the burnout rate in education is catastrophic right now. We lose staff every summer. Unemployment insurance would be a way to prevent the loss of staff to those higher paying jobs each year. It's time to fix it, not next year when we've lost more staff, but now. Do you have the courage to make the change that many of us need, or will support staff be told their value once again? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bill Schwann, followed by Mick Kelly. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Good morning. My name is William Schwant. I am a special education paraprofessional from Bloomington, Minnesota. I'm also the president of our local paraprofessional union. I represent over 300 paraprofessionals, of which 60% of those individuals work second and or third jobs to make ends meet, and 42% of them are the primary wage earner in their home. I'm here today to speak in favor of the proposed legislation making hourly school employees and higher educational employees eligible for unemployment insurance. Education support professionals are the individuals that make school happen. We are the professionals who are often the first people to see students in the morning and the last to see them at the end of the day. We transport and serve nutritious meals. We answer phones and clean buildings. We work side by side in classrooms with the youngest students and those with the most needs to help them reach their fullest potential. We are there to wipe a nose, dry some tears, zip a coat, or simply give a hug when needed. Before the pandemic, ESPs were a necessary part of the school environment. Once COVID became part of our lives, we were told we were essential. Whether it was providing childcare for frontline medical staff or making and delivering meals to families' homes. We cleaned and sanitized buildings and classrooms and provided tech support for teachers and students alike. Hourly school workers were on the front lines before it was known how the virus spread and before there was a vaccine. We were essential then, and we are still essential. As we started this school year, it was widely publicized that there were shortages of many hourly school employees. There are shortages of bus drivers, custodians, food service workers, and paraprofessionals. There's always been a shortage. But because of the needs of students after the pandemic, that shortage is now magnified. There are a number of reasons why there have been shortages, and they range from respect to the safety of our schools, but the bottom line is been pay. ESPs are the lowest paid group of employees in public schools. And on top of the low pay, our opportunities to work are limited by the school calendar. We are seasonal workers. We are at the mercy of the school calendar, and when there is no school, there's no work, and when there's no work, there is no pay. Hourly school employees are no different than any other group that works seasonally. It is not questioned when construction or resort workers collect unemployment in their off seasons, but when the discussion of hourly school employees comes up, there are groups who will argue that schools can't afford it, or how will we find anyone to work in summer school? And we know that there is funding available, and paraprofessionals will always step up. The last thing I would like to leave with this thought is we have a shortage of staff. And we have the ability to use this as an incentive to get people to take on these jobs that are so imperative to making public school happen. And I know that other trades that do have the opportunity do use that. So please make hourly school employees eligible for unemployment insurance. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Mick Kelly, followed by Christina. Christina, please also be up by the testifying table, and then followed by Maggie. Mick Kelly, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify for House File 20. It's a truly important measure. My name is Mick Kelly. I'm a member of Teamster Local 320, and I've been a cook at the University of Minnesota for the past 21 years. And I've seen what it means to have workers face unemployment again and again. We have a reality where we're hired for 12 months, and many of us expected to work 12 months, but the reality is there's many summers when we haven't worked. And as a union steward, I get calls all the time from workers, how can I pay my mortgage? I'm behind on my rent. What am I going to do? And the reality is people cannot collect unemployment benefits, and it's an extremely serious measure. I work in a place called Pioneer Hall at the university, and I think probably some of you have seen it on television. It's actually one of the more well-known dining halls in the country at this point because it wasn't able to serve food to students. There's an incredible staffing shortage at the University of Minnesota, particularly among those of us in dining. And part of the story is the instability that's created by workers not having summer work or not knowing if they're going to be working in the summer. It's a very, very difficult way to live, and you all have a chance to address this extremely important measure. I hope you do the right thing and move forward with House File 20. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next testifier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Christina McGee, and I'm with Local 320, and I work for the University of Minnesota. To whom it may concern, I'm a Black African-American female, a single mother of five, and I've been working for the university for 7 years, and it's just been hard. I can't just do it all alone, you know what I'm saying? But I've been doing it, like, it's just been, like, really hard for me. I had to pick up a second job. And if it wasn't for me having Section 8, I'd probably be homeless like everybody else with five kids. And I work very hard. And I think this is more important because people have been behind on their bills. Like, I was behind on my bills. But luckily, I picked up a second job to stay out with my rent so I wouldn't be homeless. So I say this is really important for us because we need this, for real. Because everybody is struggling at the university. I know many people who lost their places. So we really do need this. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Maggie Viscoso. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yep. So, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maggie Viscoso. I know it's hard to pronounce. It's Czech, but so I'm a student service disability assistant, senior, at Hennepin Technical College. I'm also a steward for the college for my union, Local 4001. I have worked at Hennepin Technical College for 35 years, which I started in 1987. So I've seen a lot of this. Trust me, I took unemployment once my first year and was shocked when I had to pay it back because nobody told you you couldn't take it. So I'm here to express AFSCME support of House File 20, which would expand access of unemployment insurance to K-12 and higher education workers between academic terms. This has been a problem for retaining workers at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities for as long as I have been there. It has become routine to expect a few people to quit and pursue other jobs because the hassle of finding a steady job for summers can just drive folks to seek unemployment for the full year elsewhere, to go out of the state system. Let me tell you about the work that I have done over the years. So when I started as a technical tutor back in 1987 for child development, and then in 1995, MINSCU was formed and I became a college lab assistant. I was known as a DEEDS facilitator, which really I had to look up again what it really meant. It designs educational experiences for students with disabilities. And then in 1988, became a college lab assistant too, and until 2018 when I became the disability assistant senior for student services, which I still do today. I have accepted temporary work in hours from 1995, starting with I got 8 hours a week. So now I'm up to 32 hours a week only during when students are in session. That still leaves you, because when you work for the state of Minnesota, you're hourly, like someone said before, you don't get paid when you don't work. So we have 5 weeks of breaks, academic breaks before, that we have during the school year that we don't get paid for, and then we have the summer. So we get a seasonal layoff letter, even though we're considered full-time seasonals. So I have taken any time, any hours that have offered in the summer that I could. Some of the temp positions that I took were in the bookstore and admissions, and they're sporadic. They're not every day. They're not every year. It depends on the budget, whatever we get. And as you know, budgets are always there. And if you're going to work in education, you're not going to get rich. You do it because of your passion, because you love to do it, and you want to be there. These roles are vital to ensuring that every college in the state actually helps with student success, not only from passing their courses, but graduating and attaining jobs in their field. Without us, the quality of program and student success would suffer. Many students would struggle to succeed in their academic programs, which negatively would affect the labor market in every corner of Minnesota. Let me tell you about the second jobs that I've held over the years, because I've never had just one job, because I can't afford to live. So personally, I've always had two jobs. I started cooking in a restaurant. I've been a personal care attendant for children. I work in gas stations. I held the chair job for the Minnesota Association for Early Childhood, for their childhood conference, and now I've started to become a PCA again. I guess that about 80% of our staff in our bargaining units hold second or third jobs just to make ends meet. So when we leave our job, we go to another job after work, and we work until we have to, or weekends. And I guess that this half of us have a second part-time job that we just keep working constantly. Without these jobs, we can't make it. This is why it's so important to have access to unemployment insurance. My coworkers don't view this as an option of first resort. We just can't afford making half our wages this summer. If there was part-time work in the summer, many people wouldn't even take this if they have another job. So it's not every person that's going to do it, because are you going to go for part of your wages, or are you going to go for a job that pays you more, because you're based on what you're making at the time? Without this, where am I at? Sorry. As you know, if you work for the state of Minnesota and you're a seasonal, you have to take 3 pay cuts in the last 3 paychecks before the summer and when the semester ends in May. This is because we need to prepare our employee share of our health insurance premiums to keep our health care access over the summer. Every year, a handful of workers, and I've had this because I'm the union steward and they come to me, that have actually had to pay the state, pay the college back, because they haven't made enough money to take out those three balloon payments that they get at the last of the semester. And they don't work spring break, so their check is even less. So when they find out they owe the college, they're very shocked. That's good. And it's usually the ones with families, because family insurance is higher than single insurance. So that we do that. So every dollar that we earn is vital. But if our second job becomes unavailable, like it did for many people during the early part of the pandemic, people shouldn't be left out in the cold for those 3 months. Please support our college workers and pass House File 20. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Next is discussion to the bill. First is Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we still have deed staff available? Can we have them? Because what I would like to do is to have them walk through the eligibility criteria. I think there's a bit of ignorance as to how unemployment benefits are actually accessible. And I think some of it has to do with the history that for some of these employers that are advocating today, they just don't know how it works because folks haven't had access to it. So I'd like to be able to provide that eligibility process for folks to truly understand the process.
Deputy Commissioner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Zhang, members. My name is Evan Rowe. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services and Operations here at DEED with responsibility for the Unemployment Insurance Program.
Thank you. Mr. Rowe, could you explain who would actually be eligible for unemployment benefits and explain the application process?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Frazier. Eligibility is, it's an individualized question, of course. It depends on the specific circumstances of a person's work. It depends on the nature of the job. However, just at a high level, one has to not be employed and one has to not actually have an offer of suitable employment to be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits. If one has an offer of suitable employment, they are generally not eligible to receive said benefits.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. And so one example that was given by a testifier was that in some cases an individual may be offered employment, but that employment may be, instead of a full week, it may be 3 or 4 days out of the week. How would that impact someone's application for eligibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there is a full subdivision in the unemployment insurance statute around defining what suitable employment is and is not. It's 268.035 subdivision 23A, and it's I don't want to be incomplete and offer an incomplete answer, but it is extensive, and there is a lot, and there are kind of a lot of very detailed provisions that say what it is and what it isn't. By and large, however, there are thresholds established in that which define, you know, kind of baseline thresholds for said suitable employment. So if somebody was offered something broadly similar, they would, in all likelihood, they would need to fulfill that employment. They would need to fulfill that employment to be eligible, or to not be eligible.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But in a situation like that, if that individual would be eligible, it would be for partial payments. It wouldn't be for the max amount under the eligibility process, correct?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct. If somebody is not available for work, there is a proportionate decrease in the available unemployment insurance benefit that is available. And additionally, right, it is a requirement under the UI statute that somebody has to be generally available and available to work to be eligible for UI benefits.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. I don't have any further questions for Mr. Rowe, but I would like to say, you know, many of these individuals, we've heard through testimony, they're already working 2, 3, in some cases, maybe 4 jobs. And the assumption and what I'm hearing is that these individuals are just going to try to take the summer off to get access to unemployment benefits. They can't afford to do that. In many cases, they're going to apply, and they're probably going to apply, they're probably going to be eligible for partial benefits, which is what is needed to sustain them. And I would argue that in many cases, that is what we need, because that will allow these individuals to stay in those jobs. It is a retention thing. It is not something that will make it harder to fill these roles. It will actually be a benefit for the employers. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Rowe, I'm glad you're up the table, too, because I think this bill, while I think it has some really good ideals to it, Representative Greenman, I really think that it's a group of employees that are helping our kids and our schools that are vital. And, again, love hearing Kat's story about how she does a good job with a bus driver. And I know she knows who her childhood school bus driver was. I remember mine as well, and it's a big deal. What we're getting into here is we have to make sure that we walk through this process carefully so we don't get into some unintended consequences. And I think we heard some fair testimony today about, again, I'm an employer. I rarely have laid anybody off just because of my business, but others have had to do that. And what concerns me is when you call people that are, and again, this may be a question for Mr. Rowe when I get to that, when you're on unemployment and you're in the summer and you get called back to work, I think it is a fair question that was asked by the school bus operators or the school district association, school board association. Some might not want to come back as easy because they don't want to either mess it up or kind of have to work for a little bit because they're still getting 50% of their pay. It's not 100%, but it's also a disruption. It's a lot of paperwork. Who manages all that paperwork? And so it's just the details have to be thought through. It seems like, ideally, it seems like it's not a horrible idea. But this is going to enter into, I believe. We have the money today. It's $300-some million. I think I've heard different numbers. This projection of 11% of the workforce would use this based on the Illinois model. That's an estimate from one state. So there's a lot of unanswered questions yet. When you start something new, it has to really be thought through. But first of all, Mr. Rowe, does somebody, when you're on unemployment, have to actively be seeking other work?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, yes. Statutes 268.085, subdivision, I'd say 15 and 16, both speak to the requirement that a worker both be available for suitable employment and actively seeking suitable employment.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, and if they offered something again, I want to go back to that. If they're offered to come back for, we have a 2-week project, a 2-week thing, and they refuse that work back, does that make them ineligible then for unemployment for the remainder of that summer?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't want to go into too many details. You know, I think when you get down to that level of kind of specificity, right? Like, I think, you know, each individual situation has to be treated individually. I'll say if they're called back for a specific duration, I think generally speaking, they would be ineligible for the duration of that callback, right? If it is truly suitable employment that is comparable. But again, the specifics will vary. I think the other point, perhaps just to note, is that, you know, employers have an employer management account where they can, you know, where they can dispute people's individuals' unemployment claims if they are, you know, if somebody is inaccurately or falsely claiming things. There is a process that they have to manage that they already use for the already unemployment eligible staff that they have, because, you know, some school district employees are still eligible for unemployment at this point.
Representative Baker.
And you're spot on, you're correct. It's a lot to sort of, again, the employer has to manage. It's a lot to do. There is a real pressure, though, folks, for an employer that when I do call Kat because I got a special project for you and you decide either you're not available, you can't, it's not worth it, I get it as an employer, and we're running out of options because I need you, and yet you don't work and you're choosing to take that unemployment, which you're entitled to if this bill passes. The reality comes down to is I fear we're gonna have a bit of more of a I don't want an adversarial role between the employer and the employee again. It's gonna put some pressure on that. Also, we don't know, why don't we just pay them more up front? Why don't we take that money and throw it into the kitty? Because what if we run out of money eventually here and we're going to in a few years, because again, we don't exactly know how this is gonna work. And I know that falls back to the school districts and they can go back to the levy with the unemployment stuff, but eventually it could become a deeper hole, just like our special ed cross subsidies have done. And then all of a sudden we've got another cross subsidy that we're sort of trying to backfill. I think those are the details. And again, to the assistant commissioner's comments, there are a lot of details that still have to be worked out. So I like to support the concept today, Mr. Chair, and I can't support the bill today, but I know it's got work to do, and I hope that we can be engaged with Representative Greenman on this, and let's get it right. Let's figure out how to do this. But this is something that seems like we're adding a lot of complexity to it with unemployment and all those other rules that come into it that are complicated. And so I just want to make sure when we start offering this up to a brand new group of great employees, it does cause some concern there. So I guess that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to remind people that we're talking about a program that the vast majority of employers, private and public, are already managing paying in. This is actually a workforce, an exclusion that is very narrow. And so when we talk about, and I appreciate Representative Baker, I know we've been hearing this, you've heard this bill last year too, and I appreciate the engagement. But when we talk about the complexity, it is something that our employers, both public and private, are doing and have been doing since unemployment insurance started. And so here, we're actually not talking about something that's super complicated. Many of our school districts are paying unemployment insurance for workers that are not excluded. That's why we have an unemployment insurance levy. So we are talking about adding a set of workers that have been excluded. And when you look at the history of why they've been excluded, it is rooted in stereotypes about race and gender. But we're not actually talking about changing the system of unemployment at all. And I also just want to address the budget piece, because I agree. I think our paras, our ESPs, our food service workers, I mean, we heard Mrs. McGee, like, she's trying to pay her rent. We heard from folks, people having two or three jobs. These workers are underpaid. And that is an issue we need to deal with. And I think the folks in Ed Finance and others are talking about that. But we should not balance the budgets of our schools, our universities, on the backs of the lowest paid workers who are struggling to pay their rent. So when we talk about the special education cross subsidy, when we talk about the budgets of our schools, I absolutely agree with you that these workers and their pay have to be at the center of that conversation. That doesn't change the need for these workers, and frankly, our resort workers, our construction workers, and any of our other workers that rely on this economic security. This is not a wage replacement for the summer. This is saying, if you can't find, if your school district doesn't offer you that summer school job at those hours, that you have the economic security to have half of your wages while you are looking for another job to pay for that. As we heard from many of these workers, like, they can't afford to take the summer and get paid $250 a week. Nobody can afford to live on that. So I think as we're talking about this, I think it's really important, and I really appreciate Representative Baker bringing in the entire conversation, because that's what we've heard. We've heard people in their real lives. But I think when we think about this, we are talking about the basic economic security that most Minnesota workers already have, and ending this exclusion to those workers.
And just because you mentioned the budget,
very quickly,
I just want to make sure too, you're right. It's the whole package. This year we're talking about extreme pressures on school districts and everybody else with paid family medical leave, with sick and safe. I mean, these other things are coming that are realities to the greater picture. So we all are all talking about employers and employee supports and getting them recruited. So it's all part of the package. Let's make sure we talk about them in depth. And I know there's more stops along the way. Thank you.
Representative Wings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Kirbysher Roe, just a question. With the advent of many more new workers and accounts, does your workforce at BEAD need to be augmented to do this, or will you be able to do it with your current workforce on UI?
Deputy Commissioner Roe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Weens, we can manage. We would be able to manage this with existing resources and UI. Just as a brief aside, is federally funded. We receive a federal grant for the administration of this program.
Okay, just one follow up. What is there any as far as your estimates of how many accounts would be added, worker accounts, in this process, with the bill's passage? That is.
Deputy Commissioner Roe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, would be best for us to wait for the fiscal note on that, but I think it's certainly something that we'll be able to share at that time.
Okay. I look forward to wait that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Samantha Santamura.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to start with one comment. I just heard Representative Greenman talk about, you know, the exclusion that these employees have faced, and as someone who's worked in schools for 10 years, you know, any of these hourly workers, if you ask them what they do, they will start with saying, we educate young people. These are essential. They are educators just like anyone else. And so I very much agree that they should not be excluded from this benefit. I also just want to, I think, give a specific kind of awe I have for school bus drivers. As someone who's worked with the young people for 10 years, has gone to graduate school for education, has gone through, you know, so much professional development and training, I would never be able to be a school bus driver. I think what we ask them to do is just really incredible. They are essentially running a one-room schoolhouse with students of all ages, and they're also driving a large vehicle and getting people to and from their houses safely. I mean, it is just amazing. I have a question kind of, I want to dig more into this kind of, first, I don't know who would have this data. Maybe if it's Representative Green, if you could speak to this, or from the Minnesota School Boards Association. So just kind of talking about, you know, in relation to how many hourly workers we have in the school system generally versus how many are offered school employment. You know, I just know from my experience, I've worked in summer school programs. You know, at a district that has 40 schools, you might have summer school programs operating at 10 schools. And even when they're operating at 10 schools, they're not serving, you know, the number of students that they typically serve. So I know that there's, in my experience, many hourly workers who want to work in the summer that just don't have that opportunity within their district. So I don't know if anyone can kind of provide data about, in relation to the number of school year workers, how many are actually offered employment.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have that data. I'm looking at Ms. Dietrich, who doesn't. This bill is going on to education finance next, and so I think that that's a really good question. I know that you're on education finance that I'm hoping we'll be able to answer. I know that, as we've heard, the concern, and I think we all share the interest in ensuring that over the summer months, I think that the workers we heard from want to work, and the parents and the students want to make sure that there's programming. And so I think that that's a great question that I am hoping that we can get an answer to, and I'll follow up with the districts on that.
Yeah, and I would... I would just say, you know, from my experience, like, I wish we had more expanded summer learning options, right? I think students, families, school districts want that. And frankly, like, because of funding, we don't have enough options. And so I think that's, you know, along with raising pay for these workers, like, that's another conversation we could have about how could we actually do what's right for kids in terms of summer learning and be able to offer more positions. Another question I had was just if you or someone else could speak to how would you see this, or how could we kind of think about how this policy might support retention of these workers? Because I know we're talking a lot about workforce shortage, and I think that there is a piece where implementing this could help us with the retention piece, because we know that when people have lapse in employment, that's part of what leads them to look for other jobs.
Representative Beeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that that's a great question, because, well, this bill right now finds us in what I think we would all agree is a very extreme staff shortage. This bill is not new, and this conversation about retention is not new to 2023 or to the post-pandemic. And what we have heard, we heard years ago, I think, and I'm seeing our friend Ed Reynoso over there, but First Student talked about and we have heard today workers talk about when you don't know what your 3 months out of your year is going to look like, and you don't have the economic security to say, well, I look for that job, or if I have only get half the hours, that I have the economic security to pay my bills. Workers, and I think a few actually said, and I know Kat over there has said she's really struggling to keep her commercial license and do it as a school bus driver, because you can take that license and go somewhere else and frankly make more money and have 12 months of work. And so when we talk about the retention and met these workers, as you talked about, really need the security to say, if a second job falls through, if the school district doesn't provide the hours that they need, if there's cutbacks, that they have, they know that they can pay their bills over the summer, just like every other worker. And I think that that's why you see, whether it's construction and other things, it is unemployment insurance, and that gap and that safety net provides an opportunity for workers to say, I'm going to stick in it until the next fall, in this case, or until the next season.
Representative Sensor Bureau.
Thank you.
Next is Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading a report about the states with the most racial progress, and guess what? Minnesota ranks 48th. We're not doing great. We're really struggling with racial equity. So, Representative Greenman, is it safe to say that this employees, many of them are BIPOC women and low-income folks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question. Yes, and I think what we heard, and I think you'll see in the data that Ms. Wolf presented, that these workers are disproportionately women, they're disproportionately BIPOC folks, they're disproportionately single breadwinners, which we heard from, and so it really is folks who are, when you talk about our disparities, at the bottom end of that disparities that we have here in Minnesota.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just one follow-up, and I promise I'll be quiet. Is it also safe to say that this is about equity and fairness and, you know, evening the playing field?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hassan. I think that that's exactly what it's about.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and then a question. The first is a comment, and I think that it's really imperative as we have this conversation, we also say our federal immigration policy is broken. And I say that because there are a lot of people that could enter the workforce into these jobs and kind of backfill our worker shortage. And I really hope that our federal partners figure this out, because this is a real big opportunity to help our kids every day in school, and to be part of the society that we live in. My question is for Deputy Commissioner Rowe. What differentiates a food service worker that is part of the district versus one that is a contract service food worker? They do the same job, but can you tell me more about from the UI standpoint?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the main differentiator, obviously, is who the employer is in terms of from a, you know, if they're employed by a contractor, that contractor is responsible for kind of provision of unemployment of the unemployment insurance benefits. If they are an employee of the school district, then that would be the entity that would be responsible for that.
Representative Brand.
Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. I grew up with a mother who was a bus driver for probably 30 years. So I watched her get up at 5 and got home at 5, and that's when after school bus routes were there. And so I see bus driving as for the entire human race. I mean, we have to educate all kids from Roseau and Thief River Falls in the winter to Minneapolis, St. Paul. I mean, education is statewide. So, you know, and I've spent my life caring for the other side of the population, the seniors. So there's a lot of parallels, though. We have PCAs, we have CNAs, we have paraprofessionals, we have, you know, a team. We have principals, we have nursing home administrators, we have superintendents, we have CEOs, we have teachers, we have, you know, we have RNs in schools, we have directors of nursing. You know, the piece is education's been built on, you know, it isn't, to me, just an opportunity to work limited by a seasonal calendar. We've set up education with a 9-month education year. And so in healthcare that runs 24 hours a day, it is full time's 2,080 hours. You work every other weekend. You work holidays. You have to, or the system doesn't work. So my concern is this team, the people that answer the phones, drive the transportation, do the housekeeping, do food service, do paraprofessional aid, all that aid work is equally important on the other end of caring for our seniors. And we have a gap that's imploding right now. And I look at this, and I like the concept of what this is, but my bigger question is these positions have openings in all of these senior settings right now. And maybe our seniors would love the paraprofessionals and all these professionals to come in the summer so that the people that are exhausted from working through COVID could get a vacation. And I think there's opportunities here for us to do that. It is suitable. It's 100% suitable employment. And it would give people a paycheck for 3 months. And so I think there's opportunities to dig deeper for the greater good of the community. Because I hear what's been said today, and I understand it. And pay, you know, the $738 a week, I calculated it out. When you take that by the 9 months of the year, that's 1,600 hours of work. And I didn't deduct the time off for breaks because I don't understand that. But that's making $18.45 an hour. Nobody's making that right now in long-term care or assisted livings for these same positions. So we have to be very careful what we do, because there's a domino effect. And so I'm all for increasing the pay and then looking at partnerships with communities and making this come to the local district for support to make sure we have bus drivers and these essential. But look at the bigger picture. Thank you.
Representative Beeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the question. It allows to clarify how unemployment is calculated, because I think that the numbers you were talking about, they are estimates. But when a worker applies for unemployment benefits, it will be what they are actually paid and then 50% of that, as Deputy Commissioner Rowe mm-hmm. said. So if you are making $15 an hour for 32 hours a week, your wage credits that you'll be able to collect in the summer will be half of that. And I think that's what we heard a lot from these workers, is that's not enough for folks to pay the rent and live on. It is an absolute safety net. And I also appreciate you talking about PCAs and others, because I agree. I mean, and this is the workforce committee, and there's lots of workforce issues. Those folks are all eligible for unemployment insurance under our current statute. And so I just want to really be clear. This is an exception to the way that our system works. This is not the general rule. And what I think we're hearing our bus drivers, our paras, our food service workers ask is just for the basic fairness that all the other workers who we mentioned, when they're laid off through no fault of their own, when they can't find work through no fault of their own, they have access to that unemployment insurance that most Minnesotans rely on.
I have Representative Ryer, then Representative Beckel-Finn, and then Representative Fazer, and then we're going to vote. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for this important legislation. And thank you to everyone who testified today. I'm speaking because I've been hearing things today that hurt my heart. We've heard from bus drivers, food service people, paraprofessionals, sharing the challenges that they face. And these are the hardworking Minnesotans we all want to serve. So I want to lift up their contributions. These are not people who prefer not to work or who are looking for some extra paid time off during the summer. We need to look out for these workers, hear their needs, and make this investment in our schools and all of the people who educate our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Becker Fenn.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. And a couple things. I graduated with 35 other people from a small school in northern Minnesota, and I still follow my school's social media online. And yesterday they posted all the positions they have open, and some of those postings have been open for over a year. And it's things like paras, food service workers, bus drivers in their school district. And listening today, I don't know why anyone would choose to go into that work knowing that they're going to face all these challenges that we heard about today. So I think as we're trying to meet those workforce shortages, it's, you know, do we actually have the people, enough people to fill all the jobs? I don't know that we do, but I think there probably are good people who would love to work for our schools and serve their community in that way. But if you know that you're not going to have a way to pay the bills, I mean, bills come monthly. It's not like your landlord gives you 3 months off because you work for a school. So, you know, I just think bigger pictures, we think of filling those roles and how we deal with the workforce shortage. This is absolutely part of that conversation. And the other thing I just wanted to lift up too that was really striking to me was to listen to especially the folks who've worked for many, many years at the University of Minnesota. You know, a flagship institution that I graduated from and a lot of people are really proud of. And the idea that those folks are working that hard and still having to take extra jobs and live in poverty, none of us should be okay with that. When we look at like what other people within the U of M system are being paid and we look at other ways we're investing in things, the idea that the folks who literally cook the food that has to meet all those standards and that nourishes our students and our people, that they would be forced to live in poverty because of our state choices of how we run our government, shouldn't be acceptable to anyone. And so I'm glad that this is moving forward, and I think it's important that it is part of the broader conversation of all the ways that we lift up workers, because, you know, I also heard the term adversarial role as far as employer to employee. Well, right now we just have an extreme power imbalance where we have folks who are struggling. You don't have time to fight for higher wages when you're working four jobs and raising five kids. So we're the ones that need to do that work to make this better, and I'm glad this is moving forward. So thank you, Representative Greenman.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Much of what I wanted to say has been said, but I'll just end with this. I grew up in Chicago, Illinois. Illinois has just done this to take care of those workers. I remember Ms. Page, Mr. Sharp, and Ms. Clarice, and those were student support workers, and I remember them because of the impact they had on my life. So I hope that we as a state can take this step and take care of those workers and no longer exclude them. Thank you.
Representative Greenman, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I really appreciate this conversation. And I just want to close with reminding us what we did last year, last session. We ended the exclusion of high school students from being able to collect unemployment insurance. This is the year to end the exclusion of the paras, the bus drivers, and the folks who serve them in campuses for them too. It is about simple fairness. And I guess I'll leave you with, I think, what Ms. Erin McKinney said from Deer Park. What are the future of our kids worth to you? And I think that that is the question that we're asking right here, is let's eliminate this exclusion. Let's treat these workers like every other worker in Minnesota and provide that economic security. And let's invest in the folks who are doing so much for our students and our kids. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask you for your support.
I will renew my motion. House File 20, as amended, be referred to the Education Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Weeman, your bill is going to the next committee. Seeing no further item on the agenda, the committee is adjourned.